class on this course, and I want to continue somehow about free entropy. So 2 weeks ago I talked about free entropy, but mostly in a context of a run variable, and in particular from the point of view of large deviations. Today I want to talk about the case of several variables and look on the applications of free entropy to operate algebras. And the large deviation point of view will be mostly a motivation for the definition of free entropy. I mean, in principle, the free entropy should still be the rate function in the large deviation principle, but I mean, this is not fully proof. It's more that you take this somehow as a motivation for the definition. Okay, so let me... Yeah, so it's about free entropy and operator algebras. Okay, so so the idea is the free entropy should somehow measure the probability that we are seeing a distribution which is not Wigner semicircle in the limit of independent Gaussian random matrices. Okay, so in the frame which we have, we consider non-commutative random variables in a non-commutative situation. So let's say we have a tracial Riemann algebra probability space. Well, so this just means this is it's put in this context as a Riemann algebra, and tau should be a trace. I mean, we have a definition for free entropy only in a tracial context, and then we are looking on random variables, n of them, in our Riemann algebra, and they should be self-adjoint. I mean, otherwise we are just looking on the real part and the imaginary part of what we have, so they should be self-adjoint. And, yeah, what do you mean with the distribution? I mean, the distribution is just a collection of all moments. Well, I mean, in a multivariable case, it's just this collection of moments. In a one-variable case, of course, we can identify this with a probability measure, but in a multivariable case, I mean, there's no probability measure, because, I mean, in general, those guys don't commute. Okay, so the distribution of our random variables is just a collection of tau applied to any word in this A. So tau of AI1 up to AIK, where the length of the word is some natural number, and the possible indices which appear there are all possibilities. So the I1 up to IK can take on all possible values between 1 and n. Okay, and then we are asking, what is the, given such data, what is the probability that we see such a distribution appearing for independent Gaussian random matrices? Okay, to make this a little bit more precise, so let us take our Gaussian random matrices. Let me denote them by capital A's. So A1 up to AN should be independent Gaussian N by N random matrices with our usual normalization, so the variance 1 over n, so that in the limit things converge. So the variance of each of them is 1 over n. And, okay, I mean, we can also write down this probability measure, maybe in the form. So we have, so this gives us a probability measure on n by n matrices, I mean, requiring that we have independent Gaussian random matrices. Gaussian random matrices mean the entries are independent, each has a normal distribution. So we can also, so this gives us a probability measure on a tuples of n by n matrices, which we can write, I mean, we have a constant to normalize things, to have a probability measure. And then, I mean, they are independent, so I mean, they have a density which just factorizes into the product of the single densities, and each of them is the one which we know from a Gaussian random matrix, and this was just, I mean, e to the minus n over 2 trace of a1 squared and so on, and the same for the other ones, trace of a n squared, and then dA1 up to dAn. Now this is just a shorthand notation for the product of all differentials of all the imaginary and real parts of the entries, those which are really independent. Okay, good. I mean, this is just another way of saying that all our, all the entries of different matrices are independent, and within each matrix, all the entries apart from the symmetry condition also should be independent. Okay, and then we know by Voiculescu's theorem, by Voiculescu's generalization of Wigner's semicircle law, that in distribution, the eigenvalue distribution of those guys, or no, no, we can't talk about the eigenvalue distribution, but in distribution, those guys converge to free semicircular family. So then we know that this couple A1 up to AN, which are N by N matrices, and if the size of the matrix goes to infinity, this converges to S1 up to SN, that this is a free semicircular family. Okay, so we know, so this happens in distribution. Also, if you take traces of any word in those guys, this corresponds, this converges to the corresponding, to tau of the corresponding word in the S's. Okay, I mean, usually we are talking about this under the expectation, but I mean, I also told you that this happens almost surely. Okay, so we have, so this happens with respect to the normalized trace in our matrices, almost surely. Okay, so this means what we are seeing in the limit, almost surely, is this distribution. So the moment of a free semicircular element. Okay, but large deviations, the question of large deviations is, what is the probability of seeing something else? Of course, this probability is very small, and it will go to zero if we send n to infinity, but I mean, essentially you want to know how it goes to zero. Okay, and what we expect is that it goes exponentially to zero, and that there's a rate function which depends on the data of what we want to see. And this rate function, that should be the free entropy. Good, so the large deviations should be somehow the probability of those matrices such that the distribution of them is close to some given distributions. Also, so we are fixing in the beginning some random variables, but we are only interested in the distribution, which means the moment. So we are asking, what is the probability that the distribution, which means moment of our matrices, is close to the moment of our given variables A1 up to AN. And we expect that this goes to zero, if this is not a semicircle, like e to the minus n squared, and then we have here some rate function, which depends on A1 up to AN, and that should be the free entropy. So this guy here, the free entropy of A1, AN, and that's what we are going to denote by chi of A1 up to AN. Okay, and in a one-dimensional case, if you only have one matrix, I mean, this can be made precise. Then you really can essentially calculate, or at least estimate, such probabilities, and you see that you really have a behavior like this, and you can derive an explicit formula for this I here, which depends only on the distribution of A, in which case you identify the distribution with a probability measure. Okay, good. But in the case of several variables, I mean, this breaks totally down, because I mean, doing it in a one-dimensional case relies very much on the fact that we have a joint eigenvalue distribution. So we have a formula for the joint eigenvalue distribution, and we have somehow to understand this formula if n goes to infinity. I mean, in the case of several variables, there is no analytic formula, and so I mean it's very hard to do things precisely. So I mean, in the free world, there's really a very big difference between one matrix and several matrices, because I mean one matrix, several joint matrix, the distribution of one matrix is still a classical object, namely a probability measure, because if you still, I mean, you have the moments, but I mean moments of one several joint operator can be identified with a probability measure. If you have several matrices, you have moments, but if your matrices don't commute, you cannot identify them with a probability measure on R to the N. If they would commute, of course, you would have a probability measure on higher dimension. Okay, but this is not the case. I mean, it's really, in a one-dimensional case, things look very much like in classical probability theory, because you're dealing with classical objects. But in in the case of several variables, things are getting very different. Good, okay, so there is no analytic formula, and actually, I mean, this is not really proved. I mean, one has some results in this direction, but I mean, it's more that we are using this here as one possible definition for free entropy, and then we are trying to understand this definition better. Okay, so let me now really define free entropy. So the setting is as before.
So we have a threshold W star probability space. Okay, and we have random variables, let's say n, a1 up to an, in a, which are self-adjoint. And I mean, the only information which we use about them is their distribution, their moment.
Okay, and then we want to ask how many matrices do we find which have a distribution, which have moments which are close to those. Okay, so we are going to define. Okay. So we define sets of matrices which are close to this, but of course we have to make precise. I mean, of course, this is not very precise. So I mean, this means the moments here should be close to the moments here, but I mean, we have to be more precise what we mean with this. Okay, and so we have to introduce some cutoff and some things. So we define sets gamma, A1 up to AN, which depends on N, R, and epsilon. So this should be the tuple of matrices, okay, little n matrices. Each of them should be a self-adjoint n by n matrix. I mean, we want to approximate self-adjoint elements, so we are only trying to do it by self-adjoint matrices. So we have to take self-adjoint n by n matrices, and we need little n of them, which is tuple, those. Okay, and the requirement is that those matrices are somehow close to those guys, and close, what does it mean? It means that moments of the matrices, so this is the normalized trace on n by n matrices, so we look on some moment, ai1 up to aik, this should be close to the corresponding moment of the little a's, ai1 up to aik. Okay. And of course, we can't require it exactly the same, so we want it to be close, depending on epsilon. Of course, in the end, epsilon will go to zero, but we require it should be less than epsilon. And we require this. I mean, we can't require this for all moments, because this, again, it would be a set which is too small. But we require this for moments up to some given length. And R should be the maximum length which we consider. And of course, in the end, we send R to infinity. Okay, but at the moment we have a dependence on R, so this is the considered length of moment, so we require this here for all moments of length less than R. So I mean, all possible indices, I1 up to IK between 1 and N, but K should not be bigger than R. Good. Okay, so this set depends, so it's a set of N by N matrices, where the moment up to length are closer than epsilon to the corresponding moment of the A. Okay, good. Now we want to measure the volume of those matrices. Okay, I mean we have now to take a measure on the set of matrices. And I mean, maybe the most natural measure would be to take our Gaussian measure coming from the Gaussian random matrices, but Voikulescu, I mean, he took the Lebesgue measure, but I mean, it doesn't really make a big difference. Okay, so I mean, I stick with Voikulescu's original one, because I mean, otherwise one has problems comparing formulas. Okay, I mean, the most natural one would be to take the Gaussian one, and actually that's what Elise Guillemet is doing. But I mean, the original definition of Voikulescu is in terms of the Lebesgue measure, but it doesn't really make a difference. Okay, so we have a volume on those sets. I mean, we are looking at sets of n by n matrices, of tuples of them, and I mean, we are identifying matrices with just r to the n squared, so we just can take the Lebesgue measure on those sets, which I denote by lambda. So this is the Lebesgue measure on the set of n by n, of self-adjoint n by n matrices, and
tuple of n, little n, capital N by n matrix.
Okay, so we can measure how many matrices we have by taking lambda of those sets, and then of course in the end, I mean, we want to send n to infinity and those guys, this to infinity and this to zero. Okay, and I should do this somehow in the right order. Okay, so we let us define chi. Let us first send n to infinity, an, so we still have dependency on r and epsilon. So this should be, ideally, it should be the limit, n goes infinity, but actually we don't know whether the limit exists, so we just take the lim sup. So we take the lim sup, n going to infinity, of, okay, we take the measure, that we take lambda of this set, okay, and we suppose that this set grows like e to the minus n squared by something, so we take the log and divide by n squared, and then we hope that we should get something in the limit. So we take 1 over n squared, the logarithm of this measure of our set gamma a1 up to an, and epsilon. Okay, and now we have to pay a little price for the fact that we took the Lebesgue measure instead of the Gaussian measure, because there is a correction term, which essentially comes from the difference between the Lebesgue and the Gauss measure. So in order, I mean, this guy here will also have a growth like n over 2 log n. Okay, so we should also add this. If we take the Gaussian measure, then we don't have this term, then it looks somehow more natural, and then it's really what we expect from the large deviation. Okay, so this is just because we took the Lebesgue measure instead of the Gaussian measure. Okay, so we define this quantity, and then of course we want approximation for arbitrarily long moments up to arbitrarily small epsilon. So we define finally our free entropy A1 up to AN as the limit r going to infinity and epsilon going to zero of chi of A1 to AN of R and epsilon. And actually, I mean, this limit here is an infimum over all R's and all epsilons. I mean, because it's clear that those sets have some decreasing properties if you make R bigger and epsilon smaller. Well, then the constraints are just getting harder to fulfill. Okay, so I mean, I suppose you see that this is a quite technical subject, and I mean, it's really not so easy to work with those, but at least, I mean, we have a precise definition. Oh, okay. But the point is to understand whether we can, understand this quantity and whether we can say anything about it. Okay, so there are some properties which one can show about this quantity. And first of all, in the case where n is equal to 1, where I only have one operator, it really comes down to what we saw last time as the free entropy, as the rate function in the large deviation. Okay, so if n is equal to 1, then really one can calculate this quantity here, one really can estimate, one really can calculate this limit, and what one gets is that the entropy of one self-adjoint random variable is given by what I had last time as the rate function, so it's this logarithmic capacity log of x minus y integrated with respect to x and y with respect to this measure mu a, which is the distribution of a. I mean, the moments, a has some moments, the distribution of a is given by some moments, and mu a is just a probability measure which has these moments. Okay, so we identify the moments with this analytic object. Okay, and then I have here some constant, which I don't specify. Okay, and of course, I mean, one important point in this calculation is actually to see that in this case, we know that the lim sup is actually a limit. In a one-dimensional case, I mean, you really can understand those sets well enough to see that there is no strange behavior if n goes to infinity. Okay, but in general, in the case of several variables, we don't know. I mean, that's one of the
technical problems in the theory that we expect that we should have a limit here, but we can't show it. Okay, so this is quite some calculation. Then, in general, so what are general properties in the case of general variables? So first of all, one has a sub-additivity. So namely, if I have the entropy of n variables, this is always less than the sum of the entropies of the single variables. Okay, and this is actually quite easy consequence of the fact that if you look on the set of microstates for A1, An, and my n matrices, which approximate those up to R and Epsilon, that this is contained in the product of the corresponding microstates for each Ai and R Epsilon. Okay, why is this? This here is a condition on all mixed moments of the A's. Okay, and if I have a condition on all mixed moments of the A's, in particular it includes conditions for each Ai itself, which is just a condition here. So this just means, I have here the independent conditions for each, for A1, for A2, and for A3, and here I have an additional more conditions, namely conditions which also tell me that mixed moments should be closed. Okay, so this set is included in this set. Okay, and of course if I take the logarithm, this product, so, yeah. Okay, so I will get here the sum. Okay, so this is a quite easy consequence from this. But in particular, it shows me also that the free entropy, it might be minus infinity, but it cannot be plus infinity. Right? Because, so we know the free entropy is less than the sum of the single variable entropies, and for those, we know, this quantity can be minus infinity, but it cannot be plus infinity. Okay, so this means the free entropy is a quantity which might take on the value minus infinity, but it cannot take on plus infinity. So, those sets are, they have a maximal growth, and we have taken account of this. So in particular, it also shows A1 to AN is a quantity which might be minus infinity, but not plus infinity. Okay, and minus infinity means, of course, that these sets here are somehow too small. They are not growing fast enough in the limit. Good, then what else? We have some kind of upper semi-continuity, but this upper semi-continuity, so let me how behaves this free entropy with respect to our notion of convergence. So the only notion of convergence which we have in our context is in distribution, which means moments converge. So assume we have tuples depending on m, such that if m goes to infinity, they converge to am in the limit. And then this implies, we don't have continuity of the free entropy, but we have an upper semi-continuity. So this implies that the entropy of the limit quantities is bigger than the limit slope of the entropies of our sequence. Okay. And again, this is a quite easy estimate, because if you know that this converges to this, then moments of this guy are close to moments of this guy. So if I have microstates which are close to this, they must also be close to this. Okay, and if you write this down, this gives you this one. Okay, then maybe the crucial property of this free entropy is, of course, it should behave nicely with respect to freeness. In the classical probability theory, classical entropy behaves nicely with independence, and so in the same way, we expect because through entropy is really the analog of entropy in free probability theory, that it should behave additively with respect to free random variables. And that's actually the case. So if A1 and An up to An are free, then the free entropy of A1 up to An is the sum of the free entropies A1 up to An. So we have the sub-additivity, so this guy is always less or equal to this guy. Okay, but in the case where we have fullness, it's actually equal. Okay, and I mean for proving this, one really has to use the asymptotic fullness of random matrices. I mean, essentially this is saying somehow that the microstates, the tuples of matrices, approximating this guy in the case of fullness, is more or less the product of matrices which approximate this and this and this. Okay, so, and this is more or less the statement of asymptotic freeness. And somehow one would also expect that one also has it the other way around, so that this can happen exactly in the case of freeness, and this is more or less the case, at least if one requires that this guy here is not minus infinity. So one also has the other way around, so if one has additivity of the free entropy, then the variables are free, and we know, and this is the case, if this sum here is different from minus infinity. Otherwise, there might be some pathological situations. Good. Okay, then maybe a related fact is that one has some maximalization properties. So, for example, one knows in classical probability theory that the free entropy is maximized if I fix the second moment exactly for Gaussian variables. So we should expect that the free entropy is maximal if we have semicircular. And that's the case. So we also have the multivariable situation. So the entropy of A1 up to An, if I fix the sum of the second variances, and that's why I am saying it should be n squared, so I have n variables, then the free entropy is maximal if and only if those guys here are semicircular and free. And only if A1 up to An is a free semicircular family. Okay, and each AI should have variance 1. Of course, then I have exactly this one. Okay, so in particular, if I only have one variable, then of course this means it's maximal. Why is it n squared? Well, it should be n, huh? Yeah. It should be n.
What is that making difference?
No, I mean here. Otherwise it wouldn't fit. I mean fixing here something means of course that I'm saying what is the, yeah. I mean essentially here this is saying that they all have the same variant. And then of course you have to adjust it to what you have prescribed here. Good. Okay. And maybe finally, let me say, I mean this kind of the proofs of those guys depend somehow crucially on the fact that we have a change of variable formula. So there is a formula which tells you how the free entropy changes if we are taking functions of all variables, invertible functions of which are nice enough. So I'm not going to be very precise on this, but at least I want to point out that there is a change of variable formula which is quite crucial for proving those things. So this is something like, if we are going over from our variables to other ones, which are functions of the old ones, so let's say yj is a function fj, x1 up to xn, and this should be invertible, so we can also go back, we can also express the x's and the y's. And of course, I mean, this f should be, in a sense, nice enough. Maybe one should think about polynomials. Then the entropy of the new variables, y1 up to yn, can be calculated from the old ones. So it's the entropy of
of the axis plus some term which essentially, I mean, is in a sense the Jacobian, in a sense, from going from one set of variables to the other ones. So what I get here, n times the log. Okay, but I mean in the non-commutative context, so I take the determinant of the Jacobian of this mapping here. Okay, but this is a non-commutative Jacobian, and what I'm taking here is actually this Fuchlich-Kedison determinant, which Uffe Hagen talked about last time. So this shows up here. So I mean, actually, I mean, if one talks about this change of variable formula, I mean, one has first to talk about what this really means. So but I'm not going into this. So this is the Fuchlich-Kedison determinant. Okay, and this, I mean, essentially is the derivative of these guys, but the non-commutative derivatives, which goes actually into the tensor product. So this is the non-commutative Jacobian. Okay, but I mean, the message is there is some formula which relates functions of variables, entropies of functions. Good. Okay, so yeah, I think that's more or less what I wanted to say about the general properties of this free entropy. But the main topic about which I want to talk is the application of free entropy to operator algebras. Well, I mean, of course, one can consider free entropy as an internal subject in free probability theory, so it should be the analog of the classical entropy, and I mean, it behaves in this way, and you can derive a lot of nice properties. But I mean, the most spectacular results about free entropy are its applications to operator algebras. And I mean, one should have in mind that free probability was invented to attack some problems about operator algebras, in particular to understand the free group factors and such things. And I mean, there have really been some progress. I mean, we have seen something before. We know that all the free group factors are either isomorphic or pairwisely non-isomorphic, but maybe the most spectacular results are coming from free entropy. And I want to give you some idea what this is. Good, so applications to operate algebras. Okay, so the hope which we have is, of course, somehow that the free entropy of variables contains some kind of information about the phenomena algebra generated by them. Okay, so that if I have variables x1 up to xn, that this should contain information about the phenomena algebra which is generated by those. Of course, I mean, we cannot expect that the free entropy is an invariant for the phenomenal algebra, I mean, because, I mean, this tells us, I mean, if we are going over to some other elements which generate the same phenomenal algebra, we are going to change the free entropy. Okay, so that's not what one can expect, so it's not invariant, but, I mean, one can refine somehow this guy, and so there's something which is called the free entropy dimension, which somehow tells you how the free entropy changes if you are adding small semicircular perturbations, and I mean, there at least we have the hope that this might be an invariant. Okay, so there is something, the free entropy dimension, which is delta of x1 up to xn, which is n plus, and then it's the somehow the behavior of the free entropy of those variables, but under some small perturbations by free semicircular elements. So we are taking the free entropy of x1, but we are adding epsilon s1 and xn plus epsilon sn, where the s's are free semicircular families which are free from the axis. Okay, and then I mean, this has some kind of growth behavior, so divide by log of epsilon, and we send epsilon to 0. Okay, and then we get a quantity which is always less than n, but it might be n or less. And the question is, yeah, what do we get there? And somehow, I mean, the hope is that what we get there does not depend on the axis. I mean, of course, the whole problem here is from the phenomenal algebra point of view, we have a quantity, but it's defined in terms of generators of our phenomenal algebra. And of course, if we are changing the generators, we get something different. Okay, that's, if you're looking for invariants for phenomenal algebras, of course, that's not what we want. We want a quantity which doesn't change if you change the generators. Okay, this clearly changes, but I mean, here, at least we have the hope that it doesn't change if you change the generators. Of course, we are far away from proving this, but I mean, at least we are going in this direction, and I mean, there are some kind of partial results. Okay, so let me here just add down to the S1 up to Sn is a free semicircular family, which is also free from the axis, from X1 up to Xn. Okay, and then, I mean, this problem, whether it's invariant from the generator, is this entropy dimension problem. So maybe let me write it down here. Entropy dimension problem. So this asks, if we have different generators for the same phenomenon algebra, X1 up to Xn, generates the same phenomenon algebra as Y1 up to Ym, so we also allow a different number of generators, does this imply, and we don't know this, that the free entropy dimension is the same. Delta 1 of Xn is the same as delta Y1 up to Ym. Okay, so this is a big question. And actually, I mean, if you know this, then you would know that the free group factors are different. Because, I mean, for the free group factors, we can calculate, at least for canonical sets of generators, the free entropy and the free entropy dimensions. So, namely for the free groups, we have very nice sets of generators. I mean, we can take the original generators, the high unitaries, which are free, but of course, I mean, Jamie talked about this in one of his lectures. We can also deform this somehow, so we can also take free semicircular elements. So the free group factors, so for the free group factor L of Fn of n generators, so this is generated as a phenomenon algebra by a free semicircular family S1 up to Sn. This is n here. This is free semicircular family. Okay. And then, of course, I mean, we can calculate the free entropy of this thing. And I mean, of course, the free entropy, so the free entropy of S1 up to Sn. Of course, because there are three, it's the sum of the free entropy of S1 plus free entropy of S2 and so on. And the free entropy of S1 is this double integral. I mean, of course, this is a number. I mean, it's not really important which number, but what is important is that this is bigger than minus infinity. Okay, so it's not minus infinity. And if you calculate delta of S1 up to Sn, okay, then I can, then it's quite easy again to calculate this because I have here a semicircular and I'm adding a free semicircular, which is just another semicircular. So I mean, I really can control this, and then you see that the free entropy dimension of this set of generators is equal to n. Okay, so this n, which really tells you which Fn we have here. So if we would know that this is an invariant of the phenomenal algebra, then of course this would allow us to distinguish different L of Fn. But of course we don't know, so. Yeah? Yeah. Yeah. No, I think, yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah, I mean I have only defined the free entropy for self-adjoint. Okay, good. I mean otherwise of course if you are not self-adjoint you could say the free entropy of A is the same as the free entropy of the real part of A and comma the imaginary part of. Okay, but I mean usually you only talk about the free entropy for self-adjoint elements. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, this fj here should be a self-adjoint function such that that this function of self-adjoint element is again a self-adjoint guy. Okay, I haven't really specified what I'm talking about. Good. Okay, good. So even without knowing that this is a invariant, I mean it contains somehow a lot of information, knowing that we have generators which have finite entropy, or maybe generators which have an entropy dimension n. Because this allows us to disprove some properties of Neumann algebras. Okay. And that's the idea what I want to talk about, namely that some properties of Neumann algebras exclude such a behavior for any set of generators. Let P be a property of a Neumann algebra, and I will talk about more specific properties soon, but let us be general for the moment. So assume we are interested in some property, like property gamma or primeness or something like this, and assume we can show, of course this is the whole crux of the whole thing, that we can show this, assume that we can show that if a Neumann algebra A has this property, then this implies that the free entropy of a set of generators, x1 up to xp, must always be minus infinity. And it must always be minus infinity for any set of generators. For any generating set of A. Okay, assume we can prove this. Of course, that's a quite non-trivial thing. But if we have proved this, then if we are now looking on a phenomenal algebra and we find one set of generators for which the free entropy is not minus infinity, then we know that it cannot have this property P. In particular, for the free group factors, I mean, we have a canonical set of generators for which the free entropy is not minus infinity. So if we have a property for which this here is true, then we know that the free group factor cannot have this property. Okay, so in particular, this would show that the free group factor has not the property P. Good. Okay, and of course, it's not clear whether I'm really able to do this, but actually, I mean, that was actually what Foucault-Lescot showed, that I mean, there are interesting properties of phenomenal algebras which really have this implication, which means that these properties are excluded for the free group factors. Okay, and that's what I want to talk about. I mean, maybe let me collect kind of the statement in the next theorem, and then I want to choose one of them for you. Okay, so yeah, the properties P, which I have addressed there, I mean, there are a few of them for which this implication is really satisfied. Okay, so let us consider a 2-1 factor. A, let B, let this be a 2-1 factor generated by self-adjoint operators x1 up to xd. So A is the phenomenal algebra generated by x1 up to xd. And then, assume that the entropy of x1 up to xd is not minus infinity. And then, really there are p's for which one has this one. And I mean, one of them is, for example, property gamma. So then, A cannot have property gamma. So I will explain a little bit later what I mean with this. I mean, this is one property introduced by Murray and von Neumann. Okay, it's one of the few invariants which to an Hessel for normal algebras. Okay, but I mean this theorem is due to Voiculescu. And then maybe, I mean then the really spectacular result is the absence of Cartan subalgebras. So if I have a generating set which has finite entropy, then this for normal algebra cannot have Cartan subalgebras. It does not have the Cartan subalgebra. Okay, so this is again due to Voiculescu. And what is a Cartan subalgebra? So this means it does not have a maximal abelian for Neumann subalgebra B whose normalizer generates A. Also such that the unitaries in A, which such that U, B, U star is equal to B, such that those generate A. Okay, so if A would be the matrices, then such a Cartan subalgebra, I suppose, would be the diagonal ones. Okay, and I mean it was an open question for a long time whether every 2-1 factor has such a Cartan subalgebra. Because in particular there are some kind of measure theoretic constructions which gives you for constructing for normal algebra, and in this construction you always have such a Cartan subalgebra. I mean there was the idea around that maybe every for normal algebra can be constructed by such a construction. But I mean showing that you don't have a Cartan subalgebra also shows that this for normal algebra cannot arise from such a construction. Okay, so I mean this really was an open problem. I mean this was somehow probably the first really spectacular result of Voiculescu on the free group factor. Because I mean of course we know that in particular what I'm writing down here for general A's is this property applies to the free group factors. Because for the free group factors we have a generating set with this property. Okay, and then, I mean, shortly after this, Lim and Ge used the same kind of ideas to somehow show that such an A is also prime. So if we have such a generating set, then this A must be prime. So this is due to Lim and Ge. And prime means it cannot be written as a tensor product of two other 2-1 factors. So it cannot be written in the form A1 tensor A2 for 2-1 factors A1 and A2. And it was also a kind of open problem whether every 2-1 factor can be decomposed in such a way. Okay. This general theorem, and as I said before, in particular, all this applies to L of Fn, so this shows us L of Fn does not have this property. Okay, so already all this applies to L of Fn. So this tells us that the free group factors have no property gamma, they do not have Cartan subalgebras, and they are prime. Okay, and of course, I mean, the statement that they do not have property gamma, this is nothing, I mean, this is not spectacular or new, I mean, this is a very old result. So this doesn't tell us anything new about the free group factors, because this was actually, I mean, how Marion von Neumann distinguished the free group factor from the hyperfinite one. They introduced this property gamma exactly for distinguishing the hyperfinite from the free group factor. Okay, so I mean, this is not really a new result, but nevertheless, I mean, what I want to prove somehow part one. Because this is more or less the easiest of these three ones, but I mean it shows the idea. So I think I mean the main idea is there, and even though it doesn't really give something new on the free group factor, I mean I think it nevertheless shows how this whole machinery works.
I mean, doing similar kind of ideas, you can also prove 2 and 3. And then you really get these new results in the free group vectors. Okay, so maybe we have a break now, 10 minutes, and then I want to show part one, that if you have a generating set with finite entropy, then the generated for Neumann algebra cannot have property gamma. And of course I will tell you what property gamma means. Okay, so let us meet again in 10 minutes. good. Okay, so what I want to do now, in 50 minutes or so of this class, is to show you proof, or if you have this sketch of the proof of part one, so namely to show that having a generating set of phenomenal algebra with finite through entropy means that this phenomenal algebra cannot have property gamma. So let me first remind you what property gamma means. So property gamma means, in the sense that we are finding non-trivial central sequences. So what is this? So a boundless sequence, what is GK in the phenomenal algebra, is central if it commutes in the limit k going to infinity with everything. So if the norm of the commutator tkx minus xtk in the 2 norm goes to 0 if k goes to infinity. Oh, okay, so I mean, of course, usually I'm looking on factors, so I don't have elements which commute with everything, but I might have even factor things which commute in limits with everything. So this should be for all x in A. And of course, I mean, there are somehow trivial ways of getting such a thing, namely you might just have tk's, which are just getting smaller and smaller, and then of course, I mean, also this guy here gets small, or you might have something which is a multiple of the identity. Of course, those guys always commute. So, I mean, to exclude this, we should exclude the situation that tk minus tau of tk times 1 goes to 0. So if this happens, then we call this sequence tk a trivial central sequence. This is an uninteresting one. So we can always produce things like this. But now if we have other central sequences, then we say that our phenomenal algebra has property gamma. So A tau has property gamma if there exists non-trivial central sequences in A. Okay, and this property was introduced by Murray and von Neumann in order to distinguish the hyperfinite factor from the free group factor. I mean, because it's quite easy to find central sequences, non-trivial ones, in a hyperfinite factor, but I mean, it's also not too hard to show that you cannot have such things in the free group factor. So which means, of course, that the hyperfinite factor to one factor and the free group factor cannot be isomorphic. Because I mean, this property, of course, gets transferred under the isomorphism. Good. Okay, so I mean, it's known for a long time that the free group factors don't have property gamma. Good. Okay, but nevertheless, I mean, I want to show that this property of the entropy also implies the absence of property gamma. So, let me give a sketch of the proof of this. Good. Okay, so what we want to show, consider our phenomenal algebra, let's say it's generated by x1 up to xp, and assume it has property gamma. Okay, what we want to show is that this means that the entropy of the generators must be minus infinity. So it has property gamma. So we want to show that this implies that the free entropy of our generators must be minus infinity. Okay, then of course it is clear if we have a generating set whose entropy is not minus infinity, we cannot have property gamma. Good. Okay, and so what we have to show essentially is, I mean, the entropy is minus infinity, so this means we are not finding many matrices which approximate the given distribution. So somehow having this property must prevent have many matrices which approximate our generators. That's the whole to a point which we have to see. Good. So what so our property gamma means that we have elements which commute asymptotically with any element. And first, what we want to do is we want to deform these elements into projections. It's much better to have projections. By functional calculus, I mean it's okay. One can change these keys to projections and still have the same kind of properties. Okay, so first change K to projections. So this means A has gamma, means by functional calculus that, okay, we find, let's say we have a theta, looks like between 0 and a half.
I mean, the theta is just to bound away our tk or the corresponding projections
from 0 and 1. And we have orthogonal projections, calling them tk, such that, so these projections are not trivial in this sense, so they shouldn't disappear asymptotically, which means they should stay away from 0 and they should stay away from 1 by something which does depend on k. Okay, so we should have bounds and asymptotically they should commute with everything. So commutator between x and pk in 2 norm, if k goes to 0, is as small as we want for all x. Okay, I mean that's the same conditions as for the pk's, but now we also have made out of pk's projections. Just by taking some functions of taking functions of the tk's, their projections. Okay, so that's somehow standard to do this. So now we can continue with this form of property gamma. And now the crucial lemma which we want to show is that if we have such a situation, then this means that our free entropy really must be as small as we want. Actually, it must be minus infinity.
But so maybe let me
let me write as in the following lemma, the crucial estimate. So let us say again what our situation is. So we have a tau ratio for the lemma algebra space, probability space, generated by some elements x1 up to xp. And of course we can assume that those guys here are bounded in 2 log. So we can, just by rescaling them, for example, we can assume that all the set moments are less than 1. And then we assume we have this situation, so we have this theta between 0 and a half. Okay, now, I mean, we're just looking on one projection. I mean, we have here a sequence of projections such that this guy here can be as small as we want. Okay, now let us just assume we take one projection and we say this is smaller than some omega. But we can make omega as small as we want by taking this sequence. We just want to see what estimate do we get on the free entropy if we have here that this is smaller than omega. Okay, but we have of course in mind that omega can be made as small as we want. So we take just one projection, which of course will be one of these pk's, orthogonal projection, such that power of p is between 0 and 1 minus theta, and commutator of this p with anything can be made as small as we want. Okay, but now of course we apply this to our generators. Okay, I mean we have these generators, we can make each of them as small as we want. We only have a finite number, so we have one common bound for all of them. So let us call it omega. So we assume that for all our generators, the commutator with this projection is in 2 norm less than omega. The omega is, I mean, this can be, okay, we can choose omega as small as we want, and I mean then one of the pk's, just for k large enough, will exactly satisfy address. Okay, and then of course what we got to show is that this means that the free entropy of x1 up to xd must be quite small. That's what we have to show. So this lemma really contains the main statement at the main work. So then we are claiming there are constants c1 and c2 bigger than 0, and these constants do not depend on omega. That's of course important. They might depend on the theta and what and v, but of course this doesn't change anything. We are going to take other pk's. Okay, then it says constants depending only on v and theta, such that the free entropy x1 up to xd is less than c1 plus c2 log of omega. Okay, and now, I mean, if we have proved this, then of course we can take the pk's here, which means we can make the omega as small as we want, but then the log of omega goes to minus infinity. Okay, so this means that this estimate has to be true in our situation for all omega, which means actually that this must be minus infinity. Okay, good. So if we have proved this lemma, then we are done. And I mean, of course, this lemma is the main function. It says that having some properties of our phenomenal algebra, this property really means that we can estimate this free entropy, but it must be very small. Good. Okay. So let me write it here. So if this is proved, then you choose the p in this lemma as one of the pk, and if k goes to infinity, this means that the omega can be made as small as we want. It means in our situation we have then that the free entropy x1 up to xt is less than c1 plus c2 the log of omega for all omega bigger than 0, which actually means the free entropy must be minus infinity. Okay, and then we are done. Okay, but of course, up to now we haven't really done anything, and we just have shifted what we want to do into the lemma, so now we really should start to do some work. So now we really should go into the definition of the free entropy. So, yeah, we have to show having this property for the axis means that we are not finding too many matrices which are approximating the axis in distribution. So somehow we have to, of course, I mean, if we have matrices which approximate the axis, then somehow the properties with respect to the axis should translate into properties for the approximating matrices, and then we should see that this means there are not many matrices which have this property. And I mean, for doing this, of course, it's important that the properties which we formulate here are properties which are stated in terms of moments. Because, I mean, our microstates, I mean, are defined by saying that moments of the matrices are close to moments of the operators. So if you have properties of the operators, which can be written down in terms of moments, and it actually should only involve moments up to some length, because I mean we only do it for finite length. If you have a property which can be formulated in terms of the moments, then I mean the approximating matrices should have at least should satisfy an approximate version of this property. Because I mean their moments should be close to the corresponding moment. Okay, so of course I can talk and talk, but at some point I really have to do some work, so let us now really start to prove this lemma. Good, so let us take a tuple of matrices which approximate the axis. So take A1 up to AB out of this microset, gamma x1 up to xd m epsilon k. Okay, and I mean, of course, we always assume that n is large enough, epsilon is small enough, and k is big enough, depending on the arguments which we are doing. Okay, so this means we are taking matrices, n by n matrices, whose moments up to order k are closer than epsilon to the corresponding moment of the axis. Okay, and of course, now, for the axis, we also have this projection. I mean, that the condition which we have on the axis involves this projection p. Yeah.
Probably. Okay. Okay, so I mean, the condition on the axis involves a projection P, which means, of course, we should also have a corresponding approximation in the matrices. Okay, but because the axis generates phenomenal algebra, I mean, this P is in this phenomenal algebra, so this means it can be approximated by polynomials in the axis. Okay, so we find a polynomial in the axis, which is as close as we want to the P, and then, of course, we can take the corresponding polynomial in the matrices. This at least is close to the P which we have. Of course, it might not be a projection, so we have to deform it a little bit to get a projection. Okay, but I mean, deforming things just means that, okay, we make epsilon a little bit bigger, or maybe we have to take K big enough and things like this. Okay, but at least we can deform those things. So then I always have to see that this deformation is really something which only involves moments. But I mean, this is okay. So this means, I mean, if you do this, this means that we find a projection Q in our matrices onto a subspace of dimension Q, which is the integer part of n times tau of p. Well, I mean, this projection P in my phenomenal algebra has somehow dimension tau of P. So if I realize this by matrices, I mean, it should be n times tau of P should be the dimension of this subspace. Okay, so if I deform this a little bit, I really find a projection of this projection onto such a subspace. And furthermore, I mean, this projection Q should be close to P, so this means that the commutator of Q with my matrices A should satisfy an approximate version of this one. Of course, because I mean everything is only close, I mean I have to make this omega a little bit bigger. So let's say less than 2 omega. Okay, so I have also that the commutator between AI and this Q in Q norm is less than 2 omega. Okay, so this is somehow the main, this is the first step that I mean I have to see if I have matrices which approximate my axis. I mean I essentially find approximate versions of the properties which are fulfilled by the axis also for the matrices. Good. And now I have to check what does this mean for the matrices. I want to see this gives some quite a serious restrictions on the matrices. There shouldn't be too many matrices which have these properties. Okay, good. So I mean, now I'm really just working on the level of the matrices. What you really have to do is to make estimates for the volume of such set of matrices. I mean, these estimates are actually quite rough. I mean, the geometry of this set gamma is very complicated. We don't really understand fine properties of them. We're just trying to make quite rough estimates. Good. Okay, so having this projection, of course, means we can diagonalize it, so we can write this Q. I mean, in the right basis, it's just the one on a two-dimensional subspace, and so on the n minus q dimensional subspace. And this u, of course, this u here is a unitary matrix, and essentially it's unique up to rotations in this space and rotations in this space. Okay, so what we are finding here is a u, which is a unitary matrix, n by n matrix, but I mean we can more or less make it unique by mod out unitary rotation in this space and unitary rotation in this space. Because that's what we have learned uniqueness. So we have a u from this space. Good. Okay. Yeah, that's a q. But of course we are interested in the a's. We want to see how many a's are there. So we want, the problem is to see this condition, what does it mean for the A's? Okay, now we are trying to write down the A's in the same basis. We have here. So we write U, A I star, U. Okay,
You also take this is the U, and we want to see, I mean, in the basis where the Q has this form, what happens with the area. Of course, we also write it as a 2x2 matrix. We just have here some entries. At the point, there's one star. Right. If you bring it here on the other side, you see that this this corresponds to this. And now we have to see, this condition and the commutator actually means that both guys here are actually quite small. Then the condition that the commutator of AI with Q in Q norm is less than 2 omega. So what does this mean? This means, of course, this commutator, of course, we can now, the U doesn't disappear, we can calculate it in this way. So this is bi, ci, ci star, di, sort of, the commutator of this matrix is the matrix, this one, 2 norm. So what is this? I mean, if you calculate this, I mean, on the diagonal, you will get zeros. That is left diagonal and off diagonal. You got a CI. You take here minus CI. Here CI star. So that's the commutator of this guy. You're saying the 2 norm of this guy is less than 2 omega. And if you are writing this, the 2 norm of this guy, if you are writing this in traces, this is the 2 norm with respect to the normalized trace. If you're doing this decomposition, it's better to go over to unnormalized traces. So we get a factor n, and then we have the trace of ci star. The two numbers, we have to multiply this guy with its joints, which means we get a ci star here, and the ci star here, and the trace of this guy is the trace of this plus the trace of this, in the smaller one. And we get it essentially twice, because what we have here and here is the same. And we have this 1 over n comes from the fact that we started with the normalized trace. And then we have to take the square root. But I mean, the difference between the trace of this and the other way around are just zeros, which you don't know. So this means that this quantity here is less than 2 omega. And remember, I mean, omega is a small quantity. So this really tells us that the trace of this guy is actually small. That's the whole point of what we want to see. And in this representation, I mean, these B's and D's, they might be big, but the fact that the commutator is small means that the off-diagonal elements are small. So what we get here is the trace of ci star is less than so we square this n over 2 omega squared, which is 2n omega squared. How about those guys? I mean, of course they shouldn't also be too big, but I mean, because we have by normalization required that the norm of xi squared is less than 1, I mean, this also means that those here must be less norm less than n. So the tau of xi squared is less than 1, so this implies that the trace of ai squared is less, I mean the trace of ai squared must be close to this, so it's less than 1 plus epsilon, let's say, we say epsilon is small, so let's say we say epsilon is smaller than 1, so let's say this is less than 2. And we are only interested in epsilon is going to 4, so we can make it as small as we want. So this means that if we are going over to the unnormalized trace, the trace of ai squared is less than 2n. Okay, I mean that's
a typical order for things which we have. So, I mean that's the right order for those guys, but the point is that those, I mean they are also with n, but they have a small factor here.
They are small. Good. Okay, so now we see, what do we see? We see our matrix is AI. If you rotate them with this U, they have an almost diagonal form. I mean, off-diagonal elements are small, and I mean, so we want to measure their volume. So this means, I mean, we're taking our measure on those sets is, I mean, we're taking from the back measure on all the entries, and of course this is given by taking the trace. I mean, what we have here is really that our matrices are sitting inside the ball with respect to the back measure. I mean, because the trace of A squared is the sum over the squares of the entries, which really is the ball with some with this radius with respect to the distance which gives our measure. Good. Okay, so we have this trace of and of course the trace of AI squared less than 2n means of course in particular that the trace of this and the trace of this both must be less than 2n. So maybe I should write this because AI squared is less than 2n, the trace of AI squared is less than 2n. Okay, so now we are now, I want now to measure the value of matrices which have this property. So let me denote by BP of R the ball of radius R in P dimensions, in RP. Okay, and then, I mean, by this, we have the following estimate. So we have estimated that gamma of x1 up to xt and k epsilon. Okay, so we are seeing if we take an element from here, then after rotating it with u, it must be of this form where we know that the radius of this is less than 2n, but the radius of this is very small. Okay, so we know that then it must fit into a product of balls, of those four balls. And of course, one problem is, of course, we only know this after rotation, which doesn't look so good. But I mean, let us write it down. So we know that this is sitting in those balls, but we only know this after rotation. So we have to take, we have to take a union over all unitaries from this set UN by UQ, UN minus Q. And then, I mean, we have. No, I mean the Q which we find depends on the AIs which we have chosen. I mean, essentially what we know is that we have a projection there. I mean, if we take microstates, then we also find a projection in matrices, and we can work with this projection. But if we change the microstates, if we change this tuple AI, then we get another Q.
Okay.
And we can't really control that. We have to average, which of course is infinitely many, so it doesn't look so good for making an estimate of a volume, writing it as an infinite union. But anyhow, I mean, we will need a second step, but I mean, at least we know, so that after doing this rotation, then we are sitting inside balls. So I mean, this BI, this is a self-adjoint Q by Q matrix, so this can be identified with a Q that this will be identified with R to the Q squared. So this is a ball in dimension Q squared, and the radius of this ball is the square root of this guy. This is exactly telling me that the sum of the square of the entries of my matrix is less than this here. So this is really the condition that I mean the ball of radius square root of 2n in dimension Q squared, then I have this CA, And this is a rectangular matrix, so it's Q times M minus Q. And because it's complex, I mean, as a real one, I have to multiply it twice as many degrees. So it's a Born dimension 2, Q, M minus Q. And the radius is now omega times 2n, square root of 2n. Okay, so here omega shows up. I mean, omega is a small quantity. That's the quantity which should make the volume in the end small. Okay, and then we also have the ball for the D, and D is a N minus Q times N minus Q matrix of, and the radius is this. Okay, we do this with U, but then actually, I mean, we don't have only one matrix, but I mean, we have this for each I, we have here. So we have actually this here to the power D. Okay, then you should observe that I'm using the same U for rotating A1, A2 up to AD. If I only would have one A1, of course it's not a big deal to say that after rotating with some U, I get a diagonal form. I mean, I could even diagonalize it exactly. So it's only, I mean, the point here is that I'm diagonalizing or almost diagonalizing two matrices with the same U. Huh? And that's the U which comes from the Q. Huh? Okay, I mean, if D is equal to 1, this doesn't tell me anything. But of course, I'm not expecting anything for D equal to 1, because, I mean, of course, in this statement, D is always, I mean, I'm only getting a non-trivial statement if D is bigger than 2, bigger or equal to 2. For D equal to 1, I mean, actually, maybe I should be clearer there. D equal to 2, D equal to 1 doesn't give anything equal to 2. Good. Okay, so the point is, I find a U which almost diagonalizes all my D matrices. But the problem is this U depends on the chosen A, which means for volume estimates, of course, I mean, after diagonalizing, there are not so many possibilities. I mean, this is somehow small, but I don't really know about this one. Okay, I mean, I can estimate the volume of this, but I'm running over this continuous U. Okay, and now the next step is that actually I'm replacing this continuous U by a finite number of U's, by using somehow a net of U's which covers, up to some small error, this whole set. Huh? Okay, so this, and of course, I mean, I should somehow know how many elements in this net do I need. And I mean, there are results of Scharek which exactly tell you. So I mean, there are results of Scharek which tells me that for any delta bigger than 0, I have a delta net of U deltas indexed by some, US, where S is in some index set, but this is a finite set. So this is a delta net of exactly the set I'm interested, namely UQ, UN, or by UQ cross UN minus Q. And the delta net means that for any element in this set, I find an element for my net here, which is in operator norm, actually closer than delta to the one here. So essentially I cover this whole guy by delta balls about those guys here. Okay, and the question is how many of those guys do I need? And I mean the result of Scharek tells me that the cardinality of this set S here, of course it depends on delta. If I make delta smaller, I need more balls to cover it. And I mean it goes more or less how one would expect. So cardinality of S is less than some constant times delta to the minus 1. I mean, if I just want to cover this guy, I mean, it's like, okay, covering balls. I mean, if I have a radius delta, I would expect that it goes with 1 over delta to dimension. So it goes like n squared. And then, essentially, because I have this freedom, I mean, I can subtract it. So it's n squared minus q squared minus n minus q squared. Where C is a universal constant, which doesn't depend on delta. And not on Q and the other things. Universal constant. Good. Okay, so this means instead of taking the U, which we get from our Q, we can take an element from our data set, which is close by, and then of course the Q is not getting exactly diagonal in this representation, but it's very close to it. Okay, and then I mean if you do the same calculations, you see this, that with this new U, the one from your delta net, you essentially get the same estimate, but of course you get a small error here which involves the delta, because you don't have the actual U, but you have only something which is close to it. Okay, so for A1 up to AD, Q and U as a bus, so we are choosing a microset state, we're getting our Q, and we have this U, but now we approximate this U by something from our data net, so we know there exists an element in our net such that U minus US is in norm less than delta, and then we are using this US for diagonalizing our matrices. Not the U, but the US. Okay. And I mean the U, I mean, so okay. Because I mean I have the difference between U and US is smaller than delta. This means of course that this delta shows up somehow in the estimate. So namely what one gets is that then the commutator between US, AI US, and U star U is less than 2 omega plus 8 delta. Okay, so again we compare now the A in this basis with US with this one, but I mean we get, because we have this difference between U and US, we get also this delta factor. Good. Okay, and then this means if you do the same as we did before with the US, I mean essentially you have to replace where we had 2 omega, you replace it by 2 omega plus 8 delta. But the benefit we have from this is that now here it's enough to go over the union of elements from our delta set, which is a finite set. So which means we have estimated our volume, our set gamma, of which in this way, so we have estimated this by a finite union of product of balls. And I mean, of course, we know the volume of product of balls, and so we have this volume, and then of course we have to multiply this with the number of elements in our union. Good, so as above, so what we get from this is that now our gamma of x1 up to xp and a epsilon is sitting inside, and now the union is just over this finite type ZS, running over this data set, and then we have US star, so this tells us that after conjugating with one element from the set, our matrices are sitting inside the balls, BQ squared, 2N, nothing changes there. The only change is that for the CIs, we have to replace the omega by the omega plus delta, more or less. So here we get omega plus 4 delta, I think, times 2n. Okay, and we have the ball of n minus q squared of the square root of 2n, US, and then up to the power d. Okay, so our set is sitting inside the union of these rotated balls, and now if we want, okay, we want to take the volume of this guy, so this is then less than the sum over all of those volumes here. Okay, so these are product of these guys, so it's the product, and then of course we have here balls, and I mean these are balls in some high dimensional space, and I mean we know of course what the volume of a ball is. Well, so we have the volume of a ball in dimension p of radius r, this is r to the p times pi over to the power p over 2, and then gamma of 1 plus p over 2. Good. So this means we can now. Estimate the volume of this ganache as follows. So the volume of our cells gamma, x1 up to xp, m, k, epsilon. So this is less than, okay, we have this union, and then we have the estimate, but this estimate always, I mean, for all u deltas, this gives the same. I mean, the volume doesn't change if I conjugate it with this u delta. Okay, so I just have this estimate here times the number of elements which I have here. And for this, we need to know how many elements do I need in my delta net, which is this result of Charik. So this is less than c times delta to the minus 1 to the power n squared minus q squared minus n minus q squared. And then I have to take the volume of those guys. And these are product of those. So I have here this product of these three balls. And I have it to the power b. Good. Okay. And now, I mean, now I have to understand this. Now I have to take the log of this guy. Send n to infinity, divide by n squared, take this correction term, send n to infinity, and try to understand this. But I mean, what I have here is now really, I mean, this is now really an analytic expression which one can control. And, okay, maybe, of course, this guy here is nothing else than 2q times n minus q. And then, yeah, I mean, what do we really have here? I mean, if we use this volume of the balls, so we have, maybe let me write it down by using this volume here. So we have here 2n to the q squared over 2 times omega plus 4 delta to the 2q m minus q times n to the q m minus q. So this is the radius to the power of dimension. And you see 2n squared is over that 2n times n minus q squared over 2. Okay, so this is coming from here, this and this is coming from here, this gets here, then I have the pi factors, which I can correct together, which has this n squared over 2, and then I have to divide by this gamma guys here factorials, which of course asymptotically I estimate by using Stirling's formula. I mean, I have to understand all those guys asymptotically, so I have to divide this by this product of this gamma. Okay, and then one has to see what happens. And what I want to do is I take my log of this and divide by 1 over n squared. Okay, and I also have this to add this d over 2 log n term, so I should see that actually they are coming somewhere here, and I mean they are really cancelling. So what I want is n over n squared, the log of lambda of gamma of this guy, plus d over 2 log n. Okay. Yeah, okay. So where do I get this log n? I mean, one has, I have here a d, I have to be careful because I get different contributions. So, I mean, I have to add this d over 2. And I mean, here essentially this d gives me a d log n term coming from here, but also this here gives me the contribution which involves a log n. Okay, and all those really together with this cancel away. I mean, one really has to check this carefully. But then, I mean, then I'm left with looking on the log of those guys here. And what one gets essentially is that this is less than T1, some constant, I mean, when I have some constants there, and then, of course, I get, I mean, if I take the log, I mean, I get this times the log of this guy, so I get 2q n minus q, the log delta to the minus 1 divided by n squared. Oh, this is coming from this term. Oh, and of course I can't forget this. So I'm getting this times log of this guy, and I divide by n squared. And then what else do I get? I get also coming from here. I mean, this has the same order. You see, it's also 2q n minus q. So I get divided by n squared, and I get the log of this guy. Plus, and I get it d times, because this appears here at its power. I get this d times the log of omega plus 4 delta. Okay, good. And then, of course, one has to see the other terms, but I mean, they just go to some constants. So they don't really depend on these quantities here. Okay, in the limit, I mean, if n goes to infinity, this goes also to some constant. Huh? I mean, here's n, and then q also goes proportional to n. This goes to some constant, so the main contribution which I have is here. And now, of course, I mean, I also have this delta there, which I haven't specified up to now. I mean, I just have chosen a delta net to cover my space of unitary matrices. And of course, I mean, the choice of delta should depend on omega. Okay, and I mean, the choice which I made is that I just choose delta equal to omega. Okay, and in this case, so if I put delta equal to omega, then what do I have here? I mean, I have, this is then the same as omega to the minus 1, so this gives me minus a log omega, this term. And I mean, here I get d times, I get log of omega. I mean, this, okay, this is 5 omega, so I get log of omega plus log of some, plus d times log 4 or 5 or whatever, but this doesn't count. So the main thing is this, and now you see, I mean, I have d times log omega minus log omega. So if d is equal to 1, this is just 0, and this doesn't go to minus infinity. Okay, for d equal to 1, this doesn't tell me much, but I mean, we don't expect to see anything there. But if d is bigger than 1, I mean, then I really have here some constant, positive constant, times the log of omega. Log of omega goes to minus infinity. Okay, so what I have here is really less than some constant log of omega if d is bigger than 2. And that's what I wanted to see. Well, I mean, I have here some estimate, a positive constant times the log of omega. And of course, I mean, one has to check carefully that all the other things really fit together nicely and don't give you exploding contributions. Yeah, but I mean, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But what I'm taking here is really, I mean, the matrices which I have here, I mean, you see I have here CI and CI star, and here these are several joint matrices. And I mean, the matter which I have put there, I mean, it's really, I mean, I always think of this as being, the entries are, this condition trace of PI squared, I mean, this is the sum over the square of the coefficients in this matrix, and you should really write it in terms of the independent ones. I mean, for the PIs, of course, I mean, you have a relation between what is above the diagonal and below because of the self-adjointness. Okay, but you take all the real part of the imaginary part, and I mean, you really say it's you think of it as being in a real space, and you have to find out what is the dimension. But the dimension of a self-adjoint complex P by P matrix is P squared as a real one. Because, I mean, you have, I mean, because you have, how many,
I mean, on diagonal you have p real ones, and then in here you have p times p minus 1 over 2 1. Of course, here you have the same. So the sum, I mean, the sum is p squared. Huh? Okay. And I mean, here I had a p times n minus, what was q? Q matrix, but I mean with any restriction, this means that's the reason why I have this factor 2, because I have a real part and imaginary part. So I mean, I'm really thinking of all those matrices as embedded into R to some power, some real space. Good. Okay, so I think that's it. I mean, it's a bit technical, but I think the main idea is really somehow clear. But I mean, for doing the estimate, it really comes down in the end of estimating volumes of these microstates. And I mean, we don't really know much about these microstates, but we are just trying to embed them into some balls. And okay, I mean, the condition which we have in our phenomenon algebra means us that some components in this ball are small. Okay, well, I mean, it's really a very rough estimate, but it's good enough really to show that there are not many matrices which approximate the given axis, and this means, in the end, that on the other hand, if we know that we have a Feynman algebra where we have many matrices which approximate generators, as we have for semicircular elements, then we know that we cannot have this property in this Feynman algebra. Good. Okay, I think that's the end.